From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. Al Gore has just been awarded the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts to limit global warming. He shares the award with the United Nations Panel on Climate Change. On today's Fresh Air, Al Gore tells us about making his Academy Award-winning documentary, An Inconvenient Truth. Also, the band Radiohead has just released a new album called In Rainbows. It's available for download on their website, and listeners are encouraged to choose their own price. We'll talk with lead singer Tom York. Later, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Bridge of Sighs, the new novel from Richard Russo. And film critic David Edelstein reviews We Own the Night, starring Joaquin Phoenix and Mark Wahlberg. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Former Vice President Al Gore won an Oscar for his 2006 documentary about global warming, An Inconvenient Truth. Today, Al Gore picked up another award, the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize. He shares the award with the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which, like Gore, was honored for drawing attention to global warming. The award cites the connection between peace, political stability, and global warming, stating, quote, "Extensive climate changes may alter and threaten the living conditions of mankind. There may be increased danger of violent conflicts and wars. The Nobel Committee is seeking to contribute to a sharper focus on the world's future climate and thereby to reduce the threat to the security of mankind. Action is necessary now." Unquote. Within hours after Gore won the Peace Prize, supporters of the Draft Gore movement were quoted saying this might spur Gore into making a late entry in the Democratic race for 2008. Political analysts, though, say that's unlikely, given the logistics and fundraising needs, and Gore's camp just as quickly refuted it. Terry Gross spoke to Al Gore last year when his book and movie about global warming, An Inconvenient Truth, had just been released.
Al Gore, welcome back to Fresh Air. You know, at the beginning of the movie, you say that you've been trying to tell this story about global warming for a long time and that you feel as if you failed to get the message across. Why was it so difficult as a politician to get the message across?
Well, Terry, I think there are several reasons. First, it's a complex issue. When you boil it all down, it's fairly simple, but it does have a lot of moving parts, and the complexity by itself is an obstacle. Secondly, there's a natural tendency to avoid thinking about subjects that might involve some psychic pain and the idea that human civilization is colliding with the Earth's environment is a painful reality. And third, it's a new reality. Nothing in our history or culture prepares us for the new reality, the new relationship between human civilization and the planet's ecosystem. We've quadrupled our population globally in the last 100 years, and we've magnified the power of our technologies thousands of times over. And when you combine those two elements, 6.5 billion people times incredibly powerful ways of exploiting nature, and then you mix in a new philosophy of discounting the future consequences of present actions, it produces this new collision that the most dangerous part of which is global warming. And so it's hard to absorb it, but I think it is now beginning to sink in. I think people are coming to grips with it, and I'm actually becoming optimistic that we're going to respond in time.
Over the years, when you were in politics, you were sometimes mocked for your environmental positions. George H.W. Bush called you Ozone Man and said if the Clinton-Gore ticket won, we'll be up to our neck in owls and out of work. Are there other ways that you think the issue was spun over the years to make environmentalists and people who are interested in reversing the effects of global warming seem like kooks?
Sure. And that's another reason that it has been difficult to communicate the truth, the inconvenient truth, if you will, about this planetary emergency. And that is that some interests, political, business, and otherwise, and ideological, strongly resist the truth here, have used every means at their disposal to confuse people, to put out misinformation, much in the way the tobacco industry tried to confuse people about the scientific linkage after the Surgeon General's report in 1964 showing that smoking cigarettes causes lung disease. They were able to confuse people about the validity of that science and continue the pattern of abuse for almost 4 decades. And basically the same thing has been going on now. And the disinformation, the ridicule, the intentional confusion, all that's part of a political strategy.
Let me mention a study that you cite in your documentary and in your book, An Inconvenient Truth. And this is a study from the University of California at San Diego. A scientist there named Dr. Naomi Oreskes published in Science Magazine a study of every peer-reviewed journal article on global warming from the previous 10 years. And in her random sample of 928 articles, she found that no articles disagreed with the scientific consensus on global warming. Then another study of articles on global warming that were published in the previous 14 years in the press, specifically published in the New York Times, Washington Post, LA Times, and Wall Street Journal, found that more than half of those stories gave equal weight to the scientific consensus and to the view that human beings played no role in global warming. So just to sum up, the scientific journals, the scientists agreed about global warming, but in these four major American newspapers, equal weight was given in half the articles to the opposing view that, that human beings are not causing global warming. So what does that say to you? How do you interpret that?
Well, it's astonishing. It illustrates the vulnerability of our marketplace of ideas, our public conversation, if you will, to manipulation by the kinds of techniques that were innovated early in the 20th century and were labeled propaganda. They're more sophisticated now. They're part of corporate PR strategies. They have been refined. And the nature of the news media has also changed, not in all media, but in a lot. And as a result, I think we're more vulnerable to this kind of manipulation. I think we've seen it in other areas as well. Before the vote on the Iraq War, 77% of the American people genuinely believed that it was Saddam Hussein who was responsible for hijacking the planes and flying them into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon and in Pennsylvania. And there have been times in our past when we've been vulnerable to being misled over an extended period, but not like now. And when there's a very well-funded, determined, unethical corporate campaign of disinformation, it can have a much larger impact on the impressions put into the minds of the American people than is healthy in a democracy.
When you were running for the presidency in 2000, did your advisors warn you against talking about global warming in your campaign?
Well, you know, some have written that that took place. My view of that is slightly different. It wasn't a warning. It was their feeling that every single news cycle every day should be focused on whatever issue would get the most traction, if you will, the most response, and move the needle on the in the horse race of the election. And in spite of that, I insisted on continuing to address this issue. But I have to say that in one respect, they were tactically correct, because often when I would discuss the issue, the formal presentation would be completely ignored in favor of some response during a Q&A afterwards on whatever the horse race issue of the day was. And over time, that inevitably led to them saying, well, look, you know, we tried this, we tried that, and that's ignored. And remember, this was at a time when, more than half of all the news articles were saying this issue may not even be real, and B, my opponent, then Governor Bush, had publicly pledged to regulate CO2, and therefore the perception, I mean, a pledge that was broken immediately after the inauguration, but the perception during the contest itself was that there wasn't that much contrast. Here was a so-called compassionate conservative who said he cared a lot about global warming and had pledged to legally force the reductions of greenhouse gases, and therefore, why would that be a fit issue for covering the campaign conflict? So to that extent, it was difficult to have a full-blown contrast presented in the press.
I guess I'm wondering if you've lost faith in the political system when it comes to global warming, if you think that there are certain issues like global warming that just have no sticking power in the political world until years and years and years later. Because you were talking earlier about how it was a very difficult issue to communicate during the 2000 election. Now you're going back to the very beginning of your political career and talking about how difficult it was to communicate that issue then, even when you had, you know, a leading scientific expert talking about it. So is politics a bad arena to talk about an issue like this?
It's a tough arena. I haven't lost faith, though, because I believe, and from my experience, I feel as if I know that the political system shares one thing in common with the climate system. It's nonlinear. It can appear to move at a glacier's pace, and then after crossing a tipping point, it can suddenly move rapidly into a completely new pattern. I've seen that happen. And when enough people absorb this message understand it and feel the sense of urgency that it demands, they will in turn demand that politicians in both parties react accordingly. And I think that there will come a time when our political system does cross a tipping point. And in that sense, I still have faith that we will respond. It's just taken 30 years longer than I thought it would.
In your political career, you were criticized often for, you know, rightly or wrongly, for being stiff, for not being as communicative and as lively as you might have been. Your reviews for this movie, the ones I've seen, largely have been very positive, both in terms of the larger issues that you talk about, but also in terms of your presentation. You've been praised for being lively and funny and engaging. A different evaluation of you than you typically got, for instance, in your 2000 campaign. So what do you think has changed?
Well, I benefit from low expectations. but I think that there are two reasons for the comments that you're referring to. Number one, I think that in a political campaign, particularly a campaign for president, the way a candidate's perceived is shaped by the constant attacks by the opposing side, shaped by the healthy skepticism that viewers and listeners bring to anything that somebody asking for votes is saying, and shaped also by the necessities of a campaign, which really don't allow you to speak about only one issue, but require you to necessarily speak, about the full range of concerns that the American voters have a right to hear your views on. And when you move from one to the other, that's a different kind of presentation. But I think there's a second reason for the comments you mentioned, and that is I have been through a lot in the last 6 years. And the old cliche that what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, I think is sometimes true. And all of us learn and grow and evolve in our lives. And, you know, your interviews are, I'm sure you've got a lot of listeners who contrast the interviews you do now with ones you did when you first started and find a new texture and depth, and you know, that's part of just living our lives.
You've traveled around different parts of the world looking at the symptoms of global warming. What's the most disturbing thing that you've seen in those travels?
The melting of the North Pole is one of the most urgent catastrophes that should be prevented as quickly as we can convince people to act. It's a fairly thin floating ice cap, and as you know, the Arctic and the Antarctic are very different. The Arctic is ocean surrounded by land, while the Antarctic is land surrounded by ocean, and that makes all the difference in the thickness of the ice. It's 10,000 feet thick in the Antarctic and less than 10 feet thick in the Arctic, much less now. We've lost 40% of it in the last 40 years. And when the ice there melts, there's a dramatic change in the relationship of the surface of the Earth there to the sun. The ice reflects 90% of the incoming sun's energy like a mirror, but the open seawater, after it melts, absorbs 90%, and that's a phase change. It sets up a positive feedback loop that magnifies and speeds up the melting process. And the North Polar ice cap is in grave danger now. And nearby, the great ice mound of Greenland is under increasing pressure from growing temperatures also. If that were to melt, it would, or to break up and slip into the sea, it would raise sea level 20 feet worldwide. The West Antarctic ice shelf that on the other end of the planet, at the other pole, is the part of Antarctica propped up against islands that allow it to be affected by the warming ocean, but also allow it to raise sea level by 20 feet again if it melts or breaks up and slides into the ocean. And these are the three areas that many scientists point to as affecting a so-called point of no return, which we need to avoid, because if we cross that point of no return, then the process of a downward spiral would be irretrievable. So we have to stop short of that.
Al Gore speaking to Terry Gross last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2006 interview with Al Gore. Today he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts to draw attention to global warming. That was the subject of his 2006 film, An Inconvenient Truth, which won the Oscar as Best Documentary Feature.
You were recently on Saturday Night Live. I'm sure a lot of our listeners saw this. And you were on as the president in a parallel universe, where you were actually the 43rd president, and you were delivering a speech from the Oval Office about how we've reversed global warming, how we're dealing with our huge budget surplus, and how much the rest of the world loves America. In fact, let me just play a little clip from Saturday Night Live. This is Al Gore.
In the last 6 years, we have been able to stop global warming. No one could have predicted the negative results of this. Glaciers that once were melting are now on the attack. As you know, these renegade glaciers have already captured parts of Upper Michigan and Northern Maine, but I assure you, we will not let the glaciers win. Right now, in the second week of May 2006, we are facing perhaps the worst gas crisis in history. We have way too much gasoline. Gas is down to 19 cents a gallon, and the oil companies are hurting. I know that I am partly to blame by insisting that cars run on trash. I am therefore proposing a federal bailout to our oil companies because, hey, if it were the other way around, you know the oil companies would help us.
Al Gore, do you sometimes play the what-if game? And do you sometimes play the game of how the world might have been different if you had become president in 2000?
Only in an alternate universe.
If it's seriously, do you think about that a lot? Do you play that game?
No, I don't. and if you were in my situation, I doubt you would either. It's just a lot healthier to look forward and try to focus on the positive things that lie ahead. And you know, it was a difficult experience, but not so much for me as it was for the millions of people who were negatively affected by the policies that had been put in place because of that election. But I made a choice to uphold the rule of law after the Supreme Court decision. There's In our system, there's no intermediate step between a final Supreme Court decision and violent revolution. And so I made a decision to support the rule of law and then to go on with my life and try to find ways to live a positive and useful life. And I'm pleased to have been able to find ways to serve in other ways, and I'm enjoying them. I've started a couple of businesses that are quite fulfilling for me, teaching some. Most of my time is spent delivering my slideshow and speaking on the climate crisis, and it's an increasing part of my time.
Al Gore, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Al Gore, speaking to Terry Gross last year. Earlier today, he was awarded the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from the National Cooperative Grocers Association. Learn more about locally owned food co-ops nationwide at go.coop. That's .coop. From Barnes & Noble, publishers of their classics edition of The Essential Tales and Poems of Edgar Allan Poe. In stores and online at bn.com. And from Miramax Films, presenting The Hoax, starring Richard Gere. Available on DVD October 16th. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Download the new Radiohead album, In Rainbows, and pay what you want. It's available on the band's website. Coming up, we talk with lead singer Tom York. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews Richard Russo's new novel, Bridge of Sighs. And film critic David Edelstein tells us about the atmospheric cop thriller, We Own the Night. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. Richard Russo's new novel, Bridge of Sighs, is a departure from his other novels, such as Empire Falls and Nobody's Fool, in that part of the story takes place abroad. But, our book critic Maureen Corrigan says happily, it's not long before the story returns to Russo's familiar terrain of upstate New York.
The dullest story ever told. That's what the main character in Richard Russo's new novel, Bridge of Sighs, ruefully calls the memoir of his life and times that he's begun writing. Lewis Lynch, or Lucy, as he's been unfortunately nicknamed since childhood, has lived in the same small town, Thomaston, in upstate New York for all of his 60 years. He's been married to the same woman for more than half his life, and he works at the same corner grocery store that his parents bought with their life savings in the 1950s. If you're not a little bored yet, you haven't been listening. But while the plot synopsis of Bridge of Sighs is as mild as milk, the experience of reading the novel is intoxicating. Almost any competent writer can write a reasonably entertaining story about extreme situations and adventures. But try writing a truly great novel about ordinary people grappling with and sometimes evading everyday emotions and ethical decisions. Only a very select group of writers, Rousseau among them, can pull off that kind of story without tricking it out in excess sentimentality and moralizing. In Bridge of Sighs, as he's done in earlier novels like Empire Falls and Nobody's Fool, Rousseau lays bare the miraculousness of the mundane. Lucy Lynch may have lived a simple life so far, but he's no simpleton. Now 60, he's more thoughtful than ever, and as he says of another character, prone to living more meaningfully in memory's twilight than reality's noonday sun. The past Lucy is drawn to, not surprisingly, is the period of his youth in Thomaston. A shy, only child, Lucy has one friend off and on growing up, a boy named Bobby Marconi, whose father is the kind of guy who gave patriarchy a bad name. Rousseau's story roves around in time as well as narrative perspective, so we readers know that Bobby these days is a famous painter living in Venice, but back then he was a hoodlum with a touch of redeeming conscience. Bobby would always shield Lucy from the other grammar school toughs until the afternoon he grows weary of Lucy's puppy-like adoration and stands by while a gang of bullies push Lucy into a trunk under a railway trestle. Locked up in that dark trunk for hours, Lucy has the first of his spells, lapses in consciousness that have plagued him for decades. There are other ills in the world that Rousseau creates in Thomaston, violent racism, water pollution from the town tannery that causes cancer rates to soar. But the trunk under the railway trestle is the novel's emblematic image of random evil. Countering that nightmare is the golden image of a small good place, the corner store that Lucy's family runs, the kind of store where folks from the neighborhood could run a tab and meat was wrapped in butcher paper, not cellophane, and tied off with string. Presiding behind the counter is one of the great creations in contemporary literature, Lucy's father, nicknamed Lulu. Lulu, as another character says, is nice all the way down, unlike most nice people who are nice just part way. Like other monumentally decent and ordinary characters in literature, Willie Loman, Joe in Dickens' Great Expectations, Lulu would be easy to ruin by a coating of schmaltz. But Rousseau's genius lies in the fact that while he celebrates Lulu's straightforward benevolence, he also makes us readers feel guiltily impatient with the limitations of his company. Here's how the adult Lucy eloquently sums up his father's mixed legacy. "For my father," Lucy says, "the world wasn't a complicated place. Its rules mostly made sense, and they were for our own good. I've always wanted to be the person he believed me to be, which at times has kept me from being a better one. A terrible realization, this." Bridge of Sighs is packed with quietly revelatory passages like that one, as well as intricate characters, plot twists aplenty, and a haunting sense of place. It's a big, fat package of old-fashioned realistic fiction wrapped in butcher paper, not cellophane, and tied off with string. And for my money, pound for pound, there isn't a better buy to be had in new fiction these days.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Bridge of Sighs by Richard Rousseau. Coming up, an interview with Radiohead lead singer Tom York. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. The British rock group Radiohead has released its seventh album, titled In Rainbows, in an unusual fashion. Instead of releasing it initially as a CD, Radiohead is offering In Rainbows as a download on its official website. Fans are asked to pay as little or as much as they want to support what they want to hear. In a way, it's the rock music equivalent of public broadcasting pledge campaigns. Reportedly, more than 1 million fans downloaded In Rainbows the first day, voluntarily paying an average of about $8. Already, there has been a small backlash, both about the sound quality of the downloads and the suggestion that the whole thing may have been a publicity gimmick for the eventual release of a standard CD. But the band still gets credit for trying, and for making some of the best-reviewed music of its era. Here's a sample from the new album, a song called Jigsaw Falling Into Place.
Just as you take my hand, just as you write my number down, just as the jigs arrive, just as they play your favorite songs, your body disappears. No longer wind up like a spring before you had too much. Come back and focus again. The walls have been in shape. They got a Cheshire cat grin, all blurring into one. This place is on a mission. Before the night out, before the animal noises, closer get cameras, before you come at all.
That's Radiohead from the new album In Rainbows. Its 1997 album, OK Computer, was named the top album of the past 20 years by Spin magazine. Terry spoke with Radiohead's lead singer, Tom York, last year, and asked what made OK Computer different from the band's earlier albums, Pablo Honey and The Bends.
When we did The Bends, we were still figuring out, I think, the basics even of how to make records. And in the process of doing that, we met Nigel, who was the engineer on it, who then went and did OK Computer with us and has stayed with us. And then when we did OK Computer, I think the difference was that it was like the kids being let loose in the lab. You know, that's how it felt. I mean,
what were you trying that you hadn't tried before?
Well, we bought all our own equipment from some of the proceeds from the bands, and it was all transportable. And so, it, you know, the equipment and the concept of recording became part of the creative process rather than something that was happening in another room over there, and we were just told to do it again. So we were trying everything we could think of, really within limits. I guess since then that's got a little bit out of hand.
So were your musical tastes changing at about this time?
They're always changing, and we're always listening to different things. Well, I mean, so one of the you know, most important things about being in a band, other than just playing together, obviously, is actually what music you're sharing, what music you're choosing to play to each other. And around that time, there was a serious sort of Ennio Morricone obsession going on in the band, which really obviously fed across into the way we were recording.
And yet there's no Whistler?
No, but there's a lot of pathetic attempts to sort of do similar sort of things. You know, I mean, we bought an old Mellotron, and, you know, we're using lots of those sort of soft distortion, like old, you know, deliberately trying to sort of emulate old recordings, which is Nigel's especially good at, mm-hmm. old recording techniques and stuff, you know.
Well, the track I thought we'd play from OK Computer is No Surprises. Do you want to say anything about writing this?
That's one of the songs that we refer to a lot, because just in terms of when we're in the midst of a song and we don't know whether we're just completely wasting our time, and No Surprises was like that all the way through. It was just, I don't know about this. And then it's amazing how, as soon as you just got a little bit of distance from it, as we're finishing the record and placing it in the record, how powerful it was, really, considering how difficult it was to make.
on No Surprises, was there anything that any moment where you realized, okay, this is actually a good track, this works?
It was as often happens, it was actually sort of finally getting a vocal that made sense, because it was so slow, and we had to do sort of, we ended up we physically couldn't play it that slow, so it's we used the old Beatles technique of record it at the natural speed you want to play it and slow it down and get this sort of strung out effect, and then singing to that was just a really quite a weird experience.
All right, well, let's hear the results. This is No Surprises from OK Computer.
You look so happy. Bring down the government. They don't speak for us.
That's No Surprises from the Radiohead album OK Computer, and my guest is Tom York.
Hi.
I'm wondering if... I've read this, and I know it's no secret that you've had...
I have no secrets.
...an issue with depression over the years.
Oh, that secret.
That secret, yes. So how do you think that's affected you as a songwriter or a singer? Just in terms of, like, you know, your subject matter or your tempos or, you know, the kind of mood you're going for... Mm-hmm.
I think it's both destructive and highly creative, and in some ways it's a blessing, because when you're in the midst of it, you hear things and see things in a different way. I mean, actually, some people do literally see things in a different way. Some people, the things actually do actually get darker, and sounds actually change, and blah blah blah. And I find that it's a In a way, it's you know, my brain is set to receive other things, and you know, the trouble with it is really that it's debilitating as well, because you have a problem. You don't have energy. You don't have, in order to, especially in a band, actually, but just generally to be creative, you need to have a lot of energy. You can't just, you know, and so you can be extremely negative unnecessarily and. But it's really not a big deal. But at the same time, I mean, I choose to talk about it publicly, because I've always had a problem with the fact that people call music depressing, because it's like, what, you don't get depressed? What, your whole life is roses, is it? You know, that to me is like, you are in denial, and you are the one with the problem. I mean, I want to go out and I listen to disco music. I go to, you know, I do this stuff, but it just so happens that I'm built to do this. This is what I do. I mean, that's fine. But, you know, and I think that's why, I chose to make a thing out of it, because it was just really annoying me.
I know that after or during the OK Computer tour, which ended up being like a really long tour, and it sounds like there were times on stage during that tour when you were kind of unraveling.
Yeah, that was weird. I mean, I don't know quite why. I think a lot of the shows were very big, and it was not interesting. And mostly it was just not interesting. It just got boring, which sounds incredibly selfish, but why would you just carry on playing these tunes? I mean, you know, the trouble with it was that by the time we'd done that record, we were so sick of those tunes. And then you're faced with the prospect of, like, having to play them for another year and a half. Which, you know, you got to do, because you got to let people know what it's about, and one of the things that we're good at is playing the tunes and blah, blah, blah. But you know, there just sort of comes a point where it's like this is you're going through the motions, and as soon as you realise I am going through the motions, this is sounding tired. That's it. You know, there is kind of no point. It's rock and roll. There's no point in you being there. It's like it ceases to be rock and roll and just becomes some sort of dodgy circus.
Well, I want to play another track, and this is from your album Kid A.
Hurrah.
And I thought we could play Idiotech.
Hurrah! I like that one.
You got a real like electronic thing going on here. When did you start getting interested in electronic instruments? And I've been really wondering if you went back and listened to a lot of like the early electronic avant-garde music of, say, the 60s.
Did actually. Yeah, when did I do that? I mean, I didn't really know much about it until, I guess, I started really collecting it up during the bands and OK Computer. I mean, the things I was really, really into at college was electronic music. I was massively into it.
Like what kind? Were you?
All the Detroit techno stuff that was coming out, and I was getting, I mean, I don't know what it was, half of it, you know. And there was all this sort of British answer to it as well. There's the Warp label in Sheffield, and they were coming out with just amazing stuff. I mean, the reason it was amazing was because I was DJing every Friday at college, and the stuff that sounded the most exciting coming out of the speakers was not the rock music. It was this minimal techno. It just sounded fantastic coming out of your Technics 1200s that the needle's a bit damaged and the speakers are kind of blowing up and you've had a little bit too much to drink and some twit is asking for the Pogues again. So you just whack on like some Warp record really loud and just clear the dance floor. But you are having the best time, and that was my sort of formative thing with electronic. It wasn't actually sort of Kraftwerk. And I knew that was the reference point, and I had Autobahn, but I didn't know, you know, the real history behind the Kraftwerk at all. You know, I came to it all backwards, as one does. And then I got really heavily back into it after OK Computer, because I'd absolutely had enough of rock music, predictably enough. You know, I hadn't had enough of being in the band, but I'd had enough of those sounds. I mean, like OK Computer was a very consciously acoustic record, using acoustic spaces very, very deliberately, hardly using any fake reverbs, using real reverbs and real room sounds, putting mics in the wrong end of the room and all this sort of stuff. And what was so exciting about electronic music is it's like literally there's no distance between the music and the speaker. It's just straight out the speaker. There's nothing else there at all.
What about with Idiotech? Did you intend for that to be electronic?
Idiotech wasn't. I mean, this is the good thing about being in a band. Is that Idiotech wasn't my idea at all. It was Johnny's. Johnny handed me this DAT that he'd gone into our studio for the afternoon, and the DAT was like 50 minutes long, and I sat there and listened to this 50 minutes, and so it was just what. But then there was this section about 40 seconds long in the middle of it that was absolute genius, and I just cut that up, and that was it. For me, that's my most exciting time, is when someone just hands me something and goes, have you listened to this? And it's nothing to do with me, and I just respond to it immediately like that. I don't have to pick up a guitar, I don't have to do this and this and this. It's just there.
Well, Tom York, thank you so much.
Thanks,
for talking
Terry.
With us.
That was cool.
Comes off when I let you know.
That's Idiotech from Radiohead's 2000 album, Kid A. The band's latest album, In Rainbows, is available as a download on the group's website, at whatever price you're willing to pay. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews the new Mark Wahlberg film, We Own the Night. This is Fresh Air. In the crime drama We Own the Night, the writer and director James Gray continues to explore the world of New York Russian mobsters, who were the focus of his first film, Little Odessa. His new film stars Joaquin Phoenix and Mark Wahlberg as brothers on opposite sides of the law. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
We Own the Night is a fine atmospheric cop thriller, but it's Joaquin Phoenix that lifts it into a different class. He's fresh off his uncanny Johnny Cash performance in Walk the Line, where he had the voice and mannerisms down, yet also went deeper to suggest how much of Cash's early outlaw persona was opposed to keep the world at bay. His work here is even subtler. Almost everything is under the surface. He plays Bobby Grzynski, although he goes by the last name Green, to distance himself from his family. He's the manager of a popular nightclub owned by Russian Jews and something of a druggie. His brother Joseph, played by Mark Wahlberg, is a cop, and don't stop me if you've heard this one because you have. But the writer-director, James Gray, has a loftier theme. In interviews, he says he subscribes to the Greeks' idea that your life is shaped primarily by forces beyond your control. Your destiny is fixed. We can debate whether destiny shapes character, or character shapes destiny, or whether Gray earns his whopping pretensions, but Phoenix gives his vision weight. The film is set in 1988, a high point in New York's crack cocaine-fueled devastation. We Own the Night is the new Street Crimes Unit slogan. Wahlberg's Joseph is helping lead it, and overseeing all is the brother's police chief dad, played by Robert Duvall, who's so marvelously at ease in his body, it's no wonder these sons have trouble measuring up. The plot kicks into gear when Joseph and his unit come to Bobby with a proposal. They're in a church, upstairs from a reception. Bobby doesn't want to be there, and is, incidentally, stoned out of his mind.
I'll be heading up this new narcotics team starting this week. Russian unit out of PSA 1 in Brighton. We're looking at this guy, Vadim Nijinsky. Served time in the Soviet Union for black market activity, come over around 1979. He's operating out of that spot, your man is El Karib.
I don't know nothing about that.
No, we know. We checked up and down the rest of the management, too. His uncle, the owner.
The old man?
Everybody else came up clean. It's just Nijinsky we're looking at.
You want me to inform?
No.
Are you kidding me?
Just observe, that's all. It's a closed community. You're our only way in right now.
Why is this my problem?
Well, the whole city's falling apart. Don't you have any sense of responsibility at all?
Let me think. No.
In many movies, the forces of destiny are dramatized by characters who can't resist the pull of criminality, like Al Pacino in Godfather 3, who says, "They just keep pulling me back in." Here it's the opposite. Bobby just keeps being pulled into law enforcement. What's amazing about Phoenix is that he makes Bobby's irresolution more powerful, more active, than other actors' resolution. The story is very conventional, which undercuts director Gray's thesis. What he calls fate, I call formula. And that thesis sometimes upstages the characters. The Russian sociopaths are far more cliched than in David Cronenberg's Eastern Promises. And Eva Mendes, as Bobby's Latina lover, starts out like gangbusters, then recedes like every other hero's girlfriend as the shoot-'em-up stuff takes over. But Gray's work, here and in his last film, The Yards, has a core of authenticity that recalls the gritty New York crime dramas of the 70s. There's little in the way of music. It's mostly an ambient whine mixed with cars on wet streets and passing planes. Wahlberg's character takes some surprising turns. He overcame dyslexia to succeed at the police academy, but the tightness in his face and body signals inner panic. What really sells Gray's notion of character is, of all things, a car chase. It's shot from Bobby's perspective, in a car behind a windshield in a hard rain. And even with his foot on the gas, he seems to be moving underwater. He can't catch up to something terrible happening ahead. When you've forgotten most of We Own the Night, you'll remember that chase and the look on Phoenix's face as events move beyond his control. And his destiny awaits.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our digital production project supervisor is Julian Hersfeld. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from MGM, presenting Lars and the Real Girl, a heartfelt comedy starring Ryan Gosling, now playing in select cities, starts Friday nationwide. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan, information at moma.org. And from Kauffman, the Foundation of Entrepreneurship, celebrating entrepreneurs creating a greener tomorrow, on the web at kauffman.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, The Almost Moon. Alice Siebold wrote the bestsellers Lucky and The Lovely Bones. She joins us to talk about her new novel. It's the story of a middle-aged woman who kills her elderly mother. Join us for the next Fresh Air.